Good morning. I welcome you to Disneyland East. It's a great pleasure for me. I am Jim Evans from the state of Illinois and chairman of their conservative union. It's particularly a great pleasure for me to be part of a group with such divergence of views in all areas, but with perhaps one common thread, that being the happy knowledge that if we are not ultimately successful in our quest, we will undoubtedly be amongst the first they shoot. And I really do feel that that is a happy state. Now, why are we here? I would suggest that the media, in its many forms, will make perhaps a number of suggestions. The Washington Post, I would surmise, might suggest that we are engaged on a quest of fanaticism. I would have to fall back on the late, great, and dear Richard Weaver's marvelous comment to the effect that fanaticism was indeed the redoubling of one's efforts after having lost sight of one's goals, and I can assure you we have not lost sight of our goals. The Indianapolis News, that bastion of classical liberal editorial policy with a Welsh accent flavored by M. Stanton Evans, would probably suggest that Josh Billings is responsible for our presence and would resort to the great quotation that the trouble with the world is not ignorance, it is indeed what people know that ain't so. And that we are here to explain to them what is so. I think not. The New York Times, Lord love them, would probably fall back once again on the late and great Richard Weaver and resort to the comment that a liberal or a socialist is one who is not a communist, but for the life of him, he can't tell you why not. And that we are here to clarify their mental muddle. Once again, not so. Perhaps the most subtle remarks, as usual, will come forth in National Review, where I'm certain Mr. Buckley will probably claim that we're here to solve a serious transportation and energy crisis. The constantly recurring problem of empty taxi cabs arriving at the Senate office building and letting off Birch Bayh, Chuck Percy, Frank Church, and Adlai Stevenson. And that our objective is to fill the taxi cabs. Meritorious, but certainly not our objective. With pinpoint accuracy, the media has once again come up with a deficit, possibly. We are here to direct our attention seriously to two very important areas of concern, the preservation or restoration of our economic and personal liberties, and secondly, our national security. I am here this morning to introduce a man whose contributions to the preservation of our national security have been most significant. He is the sponsor of Radio's Washington Report and Radio Free Americas. He is the producer of Only the Strong, that magnificent television documentary that was seen on over 800 television stations. He is editor of the biweekly newsletter Washington Report, and he is president of the American Security Council, Mr. John M. Fisher.
Thank you, Jim. It's appropriate that this morning the first thing we'll be talking about national defense problems, because this is the problem that if you don't solve that, how well you do on the other problems isn't going to count for much. We have Admiral Zumwalt here to talk about national defense problems. he's especially qualified on two major counts. First, he has the knowledge, the background, and the experience. But second, and perhaps more important, he's willing to tell it like it is. And that's kind of unique in Washington today. He retired as Chief of Naval Operations last July after 4 years in that tour of duty. His experience leading up to that, making him the youngest CNO we've ever had, was service at sea on 8 ships. He commanded 3. He also commanded a cruiser destroyer flotilla, Flotilla 7. He organized and directed the Office of Systems Analysis and the Office of Naval Operations. That was set up to outwiz McNamara's whiz kids. He was Director of Arms Control in the International Security Agency, Executive Assistant to the Secretary of the Navy, and Commander of U.S. Naval Forces in Vietnam. Admiral Zumwalt and his predecessor, however, destroyed more ships in our Navy than any enemy admiral ever did. He went from 976 ships in the last 5 years to 508. Because he didn't have the money to both keep the ships we had and to build new ships, he opted to build some new ships, not as many new ships as he'd like to have. And he's been warning the American people, telling it like it is, that we've lost control of the sea lanes, or at least some of the sea lanes, to the Soviet Navy. When I say he tells it like it is, when he was still in uniform, he was asked if he thought the Soviets might cheat on the ABM treaty. And I'll quote. He said, "Yes, I do. Though at the present time our intelligence has no information that they have already cheated, the Soviets have never failed to cheat when they believed they would get away with it." Now, are there many men in Washington today who are that honest and that forthright in a period of so-called detente? Admiral Zumwalt is going to tell it like it is, but as near as he can this morning, because he has laryngitis, but I'm sure it's still going to come through as right on. Admiral Zumwalt.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. The presence of the ladies constrains me to report that when the Navy did itself the honor a couple of years ago of selecting for the first time a woman to be an admiral, and my picture appeared on the papers around the land as she was being awarded her 2 stars, I was pictured kissing her. I received a letter soon thereafter from an old friend which said, "Dear Bud, I never thought I'd live to see the day when the Chief of Naval Operations was kissing an admiral." I sat down and wrote right back, "Old friend, you should be aware that nobody ever becomes the Chief of Naval Operations without having kissed a lot of admirals." This year, as each year for the last 5 or 6, the administration and the Defense Department is testifying that although things would be tough, we could make it in a conventional war with the Soviet Union if we had to. And this is the standard that has to be used, apparently, according to the political wisdom in our democratic system. Where it is not considered politically feasible to admit as an administration that we have gotten behind, or to put the Congress of the United States and its key committees in the position of having to be blamed for us having gotten behind. I think the only way that one can really evaluate what has happened is to go back a number of years and get a running start in order to examine the trends. I'd like to go back 12 years and 4 months to the Cuban Missile Crisis of October of 1962. There, you'll recall that the man who is today the foreign minister of the Soviet Union looked into the eyes of the President of the United States and lied to him as the Soviets were installing their missiles covertly in Cuba. And when Mr. Kennedy made his speech and we went on alert and the forces were deployed, and when, as Secretary Rusk suggested, we stood eyeball to eyeball until the Soviets blinked, you can be very sure that it was because they had made the rational calculation that they had no alternative. We reckoned at the time that we had strategic nuclear superiority on the order of 4-1. Remember that number. After the Soviets had done their sums and concluded that they certainly could not risk a nuclear exchange, they then had to make the calculation as to whether, gambling that we would not use nuclear weapons, they could bull their way through our maritime forces around Cuba. And again, they came to the only rational conclusion they could come to. They could not get away with it. They tested it and turned back. They didn't like their alternatives elsewhere around the world. They backed down, and we gave them a graceful and a face-saving way to do so. The Soviets, through their emissary, let it be known that they would never again be caught with their missiles down. And they embarked upon three programs. First, a tactic, the test ban. Second, the largest strategic construction program in history. Third, the second largest maritime construction program in history, exceeded only by our own World War II naval expansion. I was director of arms control in the office of the Secretary of Defense at the time. We had been trying to negotiate a test ban for months. The Soviets had blocked us at every turn. In the fright of that Cuban Missile Crisis, they changed their tune within a matter of days. It began to be apparent through signals they were sending through various embassies that a way could be found to break through. Within a matter of weeks, we were confident we could get one on terms favorable, and within a matter of months, we had one. For the Soviets, it was a tactic, temporary detente while they built to reverse the situation. For those of us in the arms control business, we considered it at the time a contract between ourselves and someone we didn't trust, someone who didn't trust us very much, but nevertheless as the first of a series of steps which somewhere down the road might just possibly lead to meaningful and fair arms control arrangements. We already had the hotline in place. We were talking already about banning weapons of mass destruction in space and on the seabeds. We were talking then about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has subsequently been ratified by most of the nations of the world. And we were talking about what we then called the separable first stage disarmament, something that later became known as SALT. Also at that time, it was the conventional wisdom around this land, through speeches on the part of our President, our Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State, to articulate to the Russians that we believed that they had no incentive to go beyond the 1,054 intercontinental ballistic missiles that we had. They had at the time about 350. Toward the end of the Lyndon Johnson administration, an attempt was made to get the SALT talks going. The newly elected Nixon administration would not guarantee to carry them forward, and they were dropped. After circling around the subject for a few months, the Nixon administration initiated the talks. Meanwhile, that fantastic strategic building program of the Soviets had gone forward. They were about to overtake us. They talked and talked and built and built. They got to 1,200 to 1,400, and when they got to 1,618 land-based missiles, they signed an interim offensive agreement and a defensive treaty. They were delighted to accept a treaty in the defensive anti-ballistic missile field where we were ahead, and they were granted two sites to our two sites, parity. In the offensive field, where they had a huge superiority, they insisted on it being recognized. They were given a 60% advantage in land-based missiles, with the option to destroy 20% if they chose to exercise their right to build up to a 33% advantage in sea-based missiles, to a 34% advantage in strategic submarine hulls, They had a de facto 300% or more advantage in megatonnage and in throw weight. Not under the treaty or the interim offensive agreement, the United States had a modest advantage in strategic bombers and a temporary advantage of about 100% in the field of warheads, MIRVs, the multiple independently retargetable vehicles, which the Soviets are now in the process of overtaking. Brezhnev announced to President Nixon that he intended to do everything under the treaty and interim agreement that he was authorized to do. He also proceeded to do a lot of things that he was not authorized to do, which are beginning to be discussed in the newspapers. The Secretary of Defense and the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff all testified to the Congress that this deal only made sense if one recognized that it was just the best that we could get, with the Soviets having been building for many years and the United States having not built additional vehicles. And we further made it clear that it was only justifiable if the major strategic programs submitted to the Congress were approved, in order to give the incentive upon the Soviets to negotiate parity in round two. We pointed out that unless we were willing to demonstrate to the Soviets that we were going to have parity without a treaty, we could not expect to get parity with a treaty in round two at reduced expenditures. The Congress passed with alacrity Senator Jackson's resolution, which in essence said to the administration, don't come back again unless you have essential equivalents. And then the Congress proceeded each year to reduce the President's strategic programs, thereby taking away from our negotiators the incentive with which to negotiate essential equivalents. And as a result, when Mr. Nixon went to Moscow in June and July of 1974, a dying president, he had two alternatives. One was to sign a deal which would give us permanent inferiority, and the other was not to sign and accept de facto inferiority. He chose the latter, less worse alternative. Mr. Ford came into office with a slightly better political base at Vladivostok. He was given a slightly better deal. In my judgment, it can in no sense be considered a breakthrough. The 2,400 vehicles that each side are authorized will de facto give the Soviets a 4-to-1 superiority, that same fourfold superiority that we had when we backed the Soviets down 12 years and 4 months ago. And the 1,320 MIRVed missiles, missiles with the multiple warheads that each side are authorized to have, will, as the Soviets complete their fantastic new strategic deployment program, give them 2.7 times as many warheads as we will have in our land-based systems. So let's call it what it is, not ice cream, but spinach. Let me just give you my personal assurance in departing this strategic area that the very best this country can hope for in the continuing negotiations in the strategic field with the Soviets is non-negotiated inferiority. Anything we sign will acknowledge that inferiority in the continuing failure of the Congress of the United States to pass the strategic programs that have been called for. Turning now to the conventional maritime field, you'll recall that we ended World War II in a position of total superiority at sea. We did not replace ships by the time of the Korean War. We fought that war with World War II ships. Following the Korean War, this nation had to make its vast expenditures for the strategic submarines and could not replace adequately its other ships. We then got bogged down in the decade-long Southeast Asia War, and the hidden tax on the Navy for that era was to forego a generation of ship building. Therefore, by 1969, your Navy was on the average technologically obsolescent, 19 years of age. Obviously, 50% of it over 19 years. The relevant Soviet number was 3% of their ships over 20 years of age at the same time. They had come from behind. They had built wisely. They went in for a huge submarine fleet, initially three times the size of ours, their attack submarines. They let it drop to only 2.5 times the size of ours as they shifted from diesel-propelled to nuclear-propelled submarines. They built the cruise missile, not having aircraft carriers, and installed it upon their submarines, their surface ships, which now number 2,054, their aircraft flying from land bases. They acquired real estate around Eurasia, and they have developed a fantastic capability. They have four times the number of ships that we have. If you count their dangerous small ones with cruise missiles, they have three times the number that we have if you eliminate the smaller ones. As John Fisher has suggested, Admiral Moore and I between us have destroyed more U.S. naval vessels than any enemy admiral in history. In the last 5 years, we have reduced your Navy by 47% of its ships, by 24% of its aircraft, and 30% of its personnel. Why? Notwithstanding the conventional wisdom of the Senator Proxmire, who say that each year the defense budget is the largest ever, and that's technically correct, just as your loaf of bread or your Chevrolet each year is the most costly ever. But if one looks at the constant dollars, eliminating inflation and the grossly accelerated costs of personnel with the elimination of the draft, in purchasing power, in constant dollars, your defense budget each year has dropped to a lower level. We're 15% below the level of expenditures the year before the war in Southeast Asia. We're 33% below the level of expenditures at the height of the war. We're at the smallest fraction of the gross national product for defense since 1950. We're at the smallest fraction of the federal budget for defense since 1950. While the defense fraction of the federal budget has dropped from 53% to 27%, the human resources fraction of the budget has grown from 30% to 45% of the federal budget. While the Soviets have increased their manpower from 2.1 to 4 million, your manpower under defense has dropped from 3.6 to 2.1. We've gone exactly the reverse. And your Navy has the smallest number of ships since 1939. Now, Jane's Fighting Ships does not have to worry about politics. Jane's Fighting Ships has suggested for the last 2 years that the superpower, the super navy of a superpower, is that of the Soviet Union. You can listen to all kinds of apples and oranges in comparing capabilities. One has to remember that the naval missions are asymmetrical. The Soviet Union is a land power. It can defeat its principal enemies, China and the European nations of NATO, over landlines of communication. It can support its principal occupied territories and client states, the Warsaw Pact, over landlines of communication. It invades them when its will is not carried out, over landlines of communication. The Soviet Union brings in a little fish from the seas and occasionally some agriculture, but with belt tightening, they can get by without the use of the seas. The United States, on the other hand, is a world island, the center of a vast maritime alliance. We have got to be able to use the seas to reinforce our allies or our own forces overseas. Indeed, if one wants to return to isolationism and just worry about ourselves, we have got to be able to use the seas to bring in the 35% of the fuel that comes in from the Middle East today, or the 50% that will come in by 1980. Western Europe bringing in 80% today, and Japan 90%. If we want just to be able to bring in the 69 of the 72 materials that the Department of Commerce suggests are critical, we have got to be able to use the seas. Viewed in that light, the United States has the much tougher mission. Our Navy has got to be able to control and use the seas. The Soviet Navy has only got to be able to cut the sea lines of communication.
This is the end of side one. At this point, you may turn over your cassette to hear side two.